Thomas Houston of Knockbracken. Just 188 years ago, on the evening of Tuesday, the 8th of April, 1828, a 24-year-old minister opened a small leather-covered journal. Here it is here. You'll be able to see it later. And he wrote on the title page, "A Diary of God's Dealings and Providences with a Most Unworthy Sinner, Thomas Houston." He had been ordained earlier that day to the pastoral charge of the Reformed Presbyterian Congregation of Knockbracken, and he was burdened with a sense of inadequacy. He wrote, "Reflect on it for a moment. How awful the charge. Who would not stagger under the weight of its responsibility? A minister of the gospel is to watch for the souls of others as they that must give an account. He is to preach that gospel by which he himself and them that hear him shall be judged. Contemplating such an undertaking, may we not exclaim with the apostle of the Gentiles, who is sufficient for these things? Lord, let thy grace be made sufficient for me. Let thy strength be perfected in my weakness." His prayer was abundantly answered. At his death, after 54 years in the same congregation, he left a fragrant legacy as a preacher, pastor, and professor. And he was mourned as the revered father of the covenanting church in Ireland. Slightly discouraging, I would like to look at it with you under that's my habit. Under 8 sections. 8 brief sections. First of all, beginnings. Thomas Houston's ancestors were Scots who had fled to Ulster to escape the killing times. And he was born at Donegore between Templepatrick and Antrim on the 12th of October 1803, the fourth child in a family of 4 sons and 1 daughter. When he was about 8 years old, his family moved to Collibaki, where he sat under the ministry of William Staveley, the apostle of the Covenanters. There was little money in the home, but he inherited the only riches that matter. "I have to record," he writes, "with profound gratitude to the author of my life, that I owed much to the instruction and training and example of simple-minded and godly parents." A clever boy, his father introduced him to the writings of Thomas Watson, Richard Baxter, and that stable of most Presbyterian homes, Thomas Boston. While he was still young, the budding preacher would read out to the family on Sabbath evenings his notes of the discourses of that day. Houston tells us that as a boy of 13, quote, "the preaching of the word and the other ordinances of the sanctuary made a deep and, I trust, saving impression on my mind. I was led to see the excellency of the Saviour and the suitableness of his finished salvation to my necessities." He was admitted to the Lord's table in his 16th year, and he had by then set his face towards the ministry. Owing to his parents' limited means, he had realized that he would have to provide for his own education. And when he was about 15, He obtained by examination a post as assistant teacher in a school at Lymore near Ballymena. From there he moved in August 1819 to the academical institution in Belfast, where he showed a particular aptitude for mathematics and won several prizes. A short period in Ballymena, where he took private lessons in Latin and Greek, was succeeded by a position for almost 3 years in Portora in Enniskillen. While there, he began a Sabbath school, canvassing for scholars among both Protestants and Roman Catholics. And mothers of the latter community were known to greet him with, "God bless the gentleman who comes to look after my poor child." He returned for a second spell at the academical institution, during which time he continued and extended his Christian work. He superintended a large Sabbath school, began an interdenominational juvenile missionary association, and was one of the six who, at a meeting in Waring Street, signed the first temperance pledge, a seed which was to develop into the Irish Temperance League, of which Houston was to be a vice president. Conscious of what he calls the ignorance and spiritual destitution of much of the population of Belfast, he joined in inaugurating the Belfast Town Mission with Alexander Henderson, then librarian in the Linenhall Library and later Presbyterian minister in Lisburn. His theological studies were pursued at the Scottish Theological Hall in Paisley under Dr. Andrew Symington, and he was licensed to preach the gospel by the Eastern Presbytery on the austerely chosen 25th of December 1826. The following Sabbath he preached at Knockbracken, walking out from Belfast on a cold wintry day, finding the doors and windows closed and locked, the congregation small, and, as he says, everything in the surrounding circumstances bleak and discouraging. After a few months, the congregation called him, and he was ordained in due course. And that takes us, secondly, to early days in Knockbracken. The Knockbracken congregation was, he writes, in a broken, dispirited condition. Besides, their character was that they had been a stubborn, perverse people. I'm deliberately not looking at any member of Knockbracken at this point in the lecture. But the young minister settled quickly to his work. His closest friend was James Dick, 4 years his senior, and the minister of Kelswater. The two men were to prove lifelong companions, preaching often for one another, allies in synod, serving over 30 years later as the first professors in the Theological Hall. They married two sisters, daughters of Robert Wallace, a Ballymena merchant, James Dick marrying Jane and Thomas Houston Catherine. Dick named one of his sons Thomas Houston Dick, and Houston returned the compliment with his son James Dick Houston. Good friends. His first diary reference to his future wife, then 22 years old, is on May the 12th, 1832. "Have seen my dear Catherine. I trust she is a chosen one, and if given to my desires, that she may be a good gift from the Lord." They were married a year later, on Monday the 13th of May, 1833. Houston moved home the previous Monday, he says, "from my present residence at Ballymacarrot to the house which I have been fitting up at Knockbracken." On his wedding eve, he wrote, "I am about to take vows upon me, the consequences of which must affect both of us for eternity. I desire nothing more than that it may be with us as at Cana in Galilee, that Jesus and his disciples come to the marriage." Early next morning, he travelled by the mail coach to Ballymena. He says, "I was not disturbed by the presence of any person, as there was no inside passenger but myself. It was a sweet season of reading the word, meditation, and prayer." See how he prepared on his wedding day. The day went well. Quote him again. "My beloved Catherine and I prayed together after our union had taken place, as we had done in our interviews before, and as we purpose to do in our daily walk in future. Thomas and Catherine were to live together for almost half a century, and she survived him for 4 years. They were blessed with 6 sons. James Dick Houston, we've heard already, served as minister of Ballyclabber from 1862 until 1910, and as a professor, like his father, of church history and pastoral theology. Their youngest son, John Knox Houston, died at 23, just after graduating in medicine with first class honours and a gold medal from Queen's University Belfast. 2 of his grandsons, sons of the Ballyclabber minister, became university professors. 1 of mathematics at Queen's College Galway, and the other of pathology in Belfast. And I won't say what Robert is going to introduce to us, and he's mentioned already, but how delighted we are this evening to have with us 2 more of his descendants, his great-great-grandson and his great-great-grandson daughter. Delightful to have you with us. We thank God for it. Houston himself could have endorsed what Principal Rainey of a later generation replied when asked why he remained so serene in testing times. "I was happy at home." Such testings had already begun. And that brings us thirdly to a longer section. Unfortunately, but realistically, the controversy. Controversy. The early 1830s were years of unrest in the worldwide Presbyterian community. The Presbyterian Church in America was agitated over the New Haven theology, which rejected the traditional doctrines of original sin and regeneration. And Archibald Alexander and Charles Hodge at Princeton were also attacking what they called the new measures of the revivalist Charles Finney. In England, Edward Irving was excommunicated and deposed from the ministry, charged with teaching the sinfulness of Christ's humanity. Thomas Chalmers was leading the evangelical party in Scotland in the struggle against modernism and patronage, which would result in the disruption of 1843. The Arian Remonstrance had withdrawn from the Synod of Ulster, but the conflict between Henry Cook and Henry Montgomery continued to divide congregations and presbyteries. The Irish Reformed Presbyterian Church did not escape this general ferment. The controversy centered round two strong personalities, Houston and John Paul of Loughborne and Carnmoney. As an accomplished theologian and author, Paul had furnished scholarly ammunition for Henry Cook and the Orthodox party in the Presbyterian Church. With his newly published Refutation of Arianism and his Defense of Creeds and Confessions, he and Houston were to be at odds for over 10 years, a period of tension which was to end in a distressing schism. The central issue was the power of the civil magistrate Kirka Sacra regarding sacred issues. The extent of the magistrate's responsibility to establish true religion. The Westminster Confession, chapter 23, section 3, states that the civil magistrate, I quote, hath authority, and it is his duty to take order that all blasphemies and heresies be suppressed, all corruptions and abuses in worship and discipline prevented or reformed. John Paul had come to question the traditional understanding of these words, arguing that the confession had in mind those who were plotting against the state. The Westminster divines, he was to write, had not the slightest idea that the civil magistrate should punish a heretic or an idolater, not the faintest conception that heresy should be suppressed by the sword. This reinterpretation, for it was no less, was to be challenged by Houston. He challenged Paul through the pages of The Covenanter, a magazine which he began to publish at the invitation of the Synod of 1830, the first issue appearing in December of that year. Early editions contained articles arguing that the magistrate's authority should extend to Sabbath breakers and blasphemers, as well as thieves and murderers. This was the acceptable application of the cherished principle of national covenanting. But as Adam Lockridge writes, stated so sternly and reiterated so frequently that the sympathies of many members of the church were alienated. John Paul, at any rate, was not slow to take up the cudgels against what he called persecuting principles. This controversy took its melancholy course, with the protagonists addressing the public in the pages of the Belfast Newsletter, firing salvos of pamphlets against each other, bringing libels and resolutions to synod. Part of the problem was undoubtedly a personality conflict. John Paul, by now in his mid-50s, and a figure of some eminence, awarded a Doctor of Divinity degree in 1836 by Union College, New York, may have been nettled by this challenge from such a forthright and competent novice, whom he describes condescendingly as our zealous young friend. Houston was more faithful to the covenanting position, but he appears to have been impatient and intemperate at times, for which he was once reproved by the Synod. Heated words were exchanged, sometimes so comically extravagant as to make our contemporary debates seem tame, milk and water affairs. "Mr. Houston's Christian magistrate," thundered Paul, "would hew down the Arminians, whether Presbyterians, Episcopalians, or Methodists. Human blood would flow like water, whilst the professed disciples of the meek and lowly Jesus were testifying their zeal for the glory of God by fines, imprisonments, tortured, and death. Such would be the consequences of Mr. Houston's doctrine. The globe we inhabit would become a howling wilderness, and Christendom a field of blood." That was his criticism. It was on the face of it unlikely that Houston wished to strap the primate of all England, of all Ireland, to the rack, or apply thumbscrews to the president of the Methodist Conference. And his defenders could sometimes adopt against Paul a tone of lofty sorrow. Listen to them. "We might be fully justified in repelling such an attack on our brother and ourselves by the strongest expressions our language could supply. But endeavouring to repress our indignation and honour, and expressing our unfeigned pity for the persons who conceived and have given utterance to charges so faithful, so awful, we simply and solemnly declare the Reverend Thomas Houston not guilty." So that was the argumentation between the two groups in the church, unfortunately. Now, this remove, we may smile at some of the overkill, but the controversy was painful, and about a matter, for covenanters at least, of no small significance. The differences proved irreconcilable until John Paul and his friends withdrew their congregations from the Synod's jurisdiction in 1840, to become 3 years later the Eastern Reformed Presbyterian Synod. This body, 10 congregations at its strongest, maintained a separate existence until 1902, when some united with the General Assembly and 5 of the congregations returned to the RP Synod. I quote Professor McCollum's verdict on the whole episode. Robert has written it well, that John Paul was seeking to lead the Reformed Presbyterian Church into what he considered a more enlightened position with respect to the power of the civil magistrate, Kirka Sacra. It's possible that he would have succeeded had Thomas Houston not entered the ranks of the Covenanter ministry with his considerable gifts. Rather than loosen the church's attachment to its historic position, Paul's controversy with Houston actually strengthened it. That brings us more positively then, fourthly, to the work of the ministry. Houston served, as we've said, as minister of Knockbracken for 54 years, building the congregation into a prosperous body with 260 members in 1860, and with many of his people moving into the capital to augment the growing Belfast congregations. This is obviously the mother of the Belfast congregations here in this book. He was a renowned preacher, as can be seen, for example, from a volume of sermons, The Dominion and Glory of the Redeemer. These sermons are exegetically solid, profoundly doctrinal, well-structured, crowned with pointed application. His morning sermons, or lectures as they were called, would often be consecutive expositions, and he would preach later in the day from single texts. A contemporary writes, in the pulpit, he had a peculiarly earnest, impressive, and affectionate manner, as one who yearned over souls. Those who have only read him can hardly have an idea of the impression produced by the living presence, voice, or that inexpressible something which moves and warms the inner man. An obituary comments that it was while addressing communicants at the sacramental table that he was at his best. He seemed like a messenger who had come straight from the presence of his blessed Lord. His face seemed to shine like that of Moses. His ministry was not confined to his own people. We find, for example, him preaching at Dundonald, Killinchy, Cumber, Newton Breda, Saintfield, Ballylesson, Rathfryland, Ballylenion, Newton Limavady, and three words this is, New Town Ards. You reckon the place, Ballyclare. There's a stranger at his funeral who had walked 2 8-miles to be there. He said, he never knew me, but when I was a boy, he came regularly to preach at my father's place. He did it for years, never received a penny for it, and I felt I must come and show my respect for him today. He preached also in Dublin, in Scotland, in Liverpool, in Manchester. He was away frequently at communions and has left us eloquent descriptions of those solemn, joyful occasions. With the various preparatory and thanksgiving services and 6 or 7 tables being served on the day itself, he was awarded an honorary DD from America in 1848 and spent almost 4 months across the Atlantic in 1856. His pulpit work was informed and enforced by what we see as diligent pastoring. He grieved over wandering sheep. Listen to his diary. Met T.C., that's all he puts, T.C., a member of the congregation in a state of intoxication, was deeply affected with such an instance of inconsistent walking. God of Israel, I pray to turn the hearts of this people. Thou only canst do it. Later, during last week, one case much affected me. an aged woman who's tottering on the brink of the grave, and who is, I have reason to fear, yet unconvinced of sin. May the divine spirit enlighten her. He took a great interest in the youth. He writes, on Sabbath evening, held my first meeting for catechizing the young. 60 or 70 might be present. My heart's desire is that there may be found many of the lambs of the Redeemer's flock among them. He evangelized around this church building. He says, I proposed to the people a plan of a congregational mission. The design being to make efforts for bringing those that are living in ignorance and sin in the neighbourhood around to the knowledge of the Saviour. It is my earnest desire that we all may be led to see more fully the necessity of such exertions. He prayed for revival. Listen to him praying near Killinchy. The whole face of the country is lovely and inviting. Everywhere around, luxuriant cultivation and splendid mansions meet the eye. But sad and distressing is the moral landscape. No dwelling in which the morning and evening sacrifice is presented to God. Few that have the fear of God before their eyes. Through fullness of bread, their hearts are waxed fat, and they're estranged from God. Oh, that the Spirit would breathe on the dry bones, that they might live. This is him writing his diary. What a man. That brings us fifthly, and it'll be briefly, to the professor. To the professor. Candidates for the covenanting ministry had always received their theological education in Scotland. From 1819, under Dr. Andrew Symington in Paisley, Houston's professor. Events in the 1840s, however, were pushing the church in Ireland towards the provision of teaching locally. To send students across the water was inconvenient, and concern about Arianism in the moral philosophy department of the Belfast Academical Institution was a constant irritant. The Synod of 1845 approved a plan of education, but nothing was done until Symington's death in 1853 precipitated the need for a decision. A theological hall was established in 1854 and two professors appointed, James Dick as Professor of Systematic Theology and Houston himself as Professor of Exegetical and Pastoral Theology and Ecclesiastical History. The hall met in the schoolroom of College Street South Church in Belfast with an initial enrollment of 6 students. 4 sessions were to be held, each lasting for 2 months. The course, we're not told about the course at the beginning, but it must have been demanding. And I know that it must have been demanding, because we can consider the plan of education in 1869, to which the students were recommended before beginning their theology. Here was what was required before beginning the study of theology: to be familiar with the Scriptures and the Westminster Confession, and to have studied New Testament Greek, chronology, ancient and modern history, antiquities and ancient geography, literature, ancient and modern languages, mathematics, science, philosophy, political economy, and jurisprudence. If any of you understand Latin, O temera, O mores, O times, O practices. The students certainly appreciated their professors. I don't think the church can have taken that absolutely seriously and literally, surely, but anyway. Students certainly appreciated their professors. The students stated in the Church magazine in 1863 that they have proved themselves to be most untiring in discharge of their onerous duties and in consistence with their dignified position, have shown the utmost forbearance towards the students. We consider it our high privilege to be placed under their tuition. Rather sorry, Robert, that none of our present students are here this evening. I quite like them to hear that quote. Sixthly, and again briefly, the author. Towards the end of his life, Dr. Houston reached a wider audience through his writings. A collection of shorter works was published in four volumes in 1876 on subjects such as parental duties, the adoption of sons, a narrative of covenanting, and the life of James Renwick. Longer works were to follow, including the Lord's Supper in 1878 and the Intercession of Christ in 1882. His books were reviewed enthusiastically in both the secular and the religious press. One of my favourites is his treatise on the Fellowship Prayer Meeting. When we came 40 years ago to the congregation where we served most of our time, I sat the people down, the little group, and week after week we worked through his treatise on the Fellowship of the Prayer Meeting. In it, he builds upon the historic covenanting practice of believers meeting regularly in small home groups called societies for the study of the word, prayer, and fellowship. He sets out the scriptural warrant for such groups, what their advantages are, and how they are to be conducted. We need to see if it can be reprinted. Because, ladies and gentlemen, in terms of body life, development of gifts, intimacy of fellowship, creative evangelism, and every member pastoral care, Thomas Houston, I believe, is far ahead of and much more helpful than most of the current publications on these topics today. But that leads us, seventhly, to his influence. His influence. What was Houston's influence on Reformed Presbyterianism? He entered the ministry when the denomination was growing rapidly. The pioneering work of men like Stavely, Orr, and Gamble had united and strengthened the society people. The equivocation of the seceders led to the transfer of some of their members to the Covenanters. The Arian controversy had encouraged support for men who were known to be faithful gospel preachers. The Synod, constituted in Culibacky in 1811, was a major step towards the Reformed Presbyterian Church playing a more substantial role in the religious life of Ireland. And Houston helped to consolidate and stabilise this process. By his preaching and writing, particularly in the Covenanter, he resisted attempts to move the church from her historic position and riveted the hearts of the people to the testimony. He shared in the training of two generations of ministers, shaping the church's development until the early 20th century. His lifelong passion for missions was evidenced in his reading a paper on the subject annually, every synod. And it was mainly through his instrumentality that Dr. Martin was sent out to Syria at the end of 1871. Houston, however, was an admirable blend of denominational commitment and evangelical Catholicity. No minister of his time was a more convinced Covenanter, as his contemporaries recognized. Yet, there was nothing small-minded or sectarian about him. It was written of him, a man of broad sympathies. The tenacity with which he held by the distinctive principles and position of the Reformed Presbyterian Church never hindered him from cooperating in any good work with evangelical men of other denominations, when he could do so without compromising himself. We're told that his funeral was attended by ministers of various denominations, some of whom took part in conducting religious services in the manse of the church. But perhaps, friends, the greatest stimulus from a study of Houston is his godliness. Friends spoke of his personal piety as his most prominent trait. One friend says no one could be in his company for even a brief period without observing that he breathed an atmosphere of high-toned spirituality and Christian fervor. And friends, this awareness, this impression, has been confirmed for me many, many times as I began transcribing several of his previously unknown diaries. I brought them here this evening. This is the first diary he ever wrote. It begins the day of his ordination, which I read out to you. And then this is the next diary, the diary which continues immediately from it, a week later, second diary, back into the 1830s. You can have a look at them later. Eventually they'll be coming into our building here. We want to get them all written out and see what happens then. But I've read it. I've written out the complete first volume and typed that out. And I'm about a third of the way through the second volume. I've been interrupted during the last 5 years by some other things that happened that I wasn't expecting. But I hope God willing to get back to it before the end of this year. This diary. To read the spidery handwriting of this young minister takes you a long time, or quite a while, to start to understand it. To read this handwriting pouring out his soul in the presence of God, with no thought of any other human eye ever seeing these paragraphs. It's a moving and awakening experience. And I hope that God will enable us to use this for his glory. He's a sensitive Christian. Let me give you some quotes. He writes, "A fortnight of the span allotted me on earth has fled away. What have I been doing? What advances have I made in the divine life, in my preparations for judgment? These are momentous inquiries, and much do I fear that I can return to them no satisfactory answer? What coldness and formality in duty! What want of zeal for the glory of God! Revive and quicken me, O Lord. Thy power alone can make me spiritually minded. That's this young man's writing by himself on the Sabbath evening. He seeks God's blessing before he preaches. This is the eve of the Holy Sabbath. It is my calling to stand between the living and the dead, to declare the whole counsel of God, to warn every man, to comfort mourners in Zion. Oh, that I may have created within me a clean heart and renewed within me a right spirit. When preaching the word to perishing sinners, may I be constrained by the Saviour's love. May I be enlightened by the divine spirit. And oh, that my feeble instrumentality may be accompanied by the working of the Spirit, that sinners might be converted and saints build up and edified. He writes that the night before. After preaching, he applies to himself the message he has just delivered. Quote, yesterday, preached at Knockbracken, both forenoon and afternoon, from James 4:17. Therefore, to him that knoweth to do good, and doeth it not, to him it is sin. What a deeply searching declaration. My sins of omission are without number. Were it not that there is rich forgiveness with Jehovah, I could have no hope. The thought would be inconceivably awful if it should be found out that while preaching this discourse, I was drawing up a bill of indictment against myself. May mercy prevent it. Oh, that I may be enabled henceforth, always, with all my might, to do the good that I know. More examples could be given. But the point is clear. The life and the effectiveness of every believer depend on his or her walk with God. A minister's heart is the heart of his ministry. Houston, for me, exemplifies what John Owen once said of our solitudes. What we are in them, that we are indeed. And no more. They are the times wherein the principle that is predominant in us will show and act itself. What we are in our solitude, that we are indeed. That's who we are. And then that brings us lastly to the journey's end. The journey's end. Houston was described as, quote, of slender make and apparently not very robust physique. And this may be why his early diary entries can strike a gloomy note. There's a slight touch of humour in here. He writes, this is a very, very, very young man. Was led to think that the period of my service on earth will be short. I have been, through the tender mercy of God, spared a little longer, if this be the last communion which I shall be permitted to enjoy on earth. He survived these slightly He survived these hypochondriac musings for another 50 years. Bit premature. And as one of his friends says, by regular and systematic habits of care, was enabled to maintain a great measure of healthful elasticity. And by economizing every moment of his time, got through a great amount of work. In 1881, however, in the midst of preaching, writing and teaching, he developed what was probably cancer of the larynx. This worsened throughout the winter, but he would not let it interrupt his studies or his work. The Theological Hall report for March 1882 states that Dr. Houston has been suffering from a painful affection of the throat, and yet he attended and labored with the students beyond what his strength warranted. Although he was urged to undergo surgery, he, quote, resolutely put it off and cheerfully encountered all risk of exposure and of labor in order to complete the duties of this session of the hall. In very inclement weather, he attended every meeting to the last. His long pilgrimage was ending, and I come now to stand for a moment in parallel with Robert. He spoke of his family relationship, and it pleases me to think that three generations of my family sat under Thomas Houston's ministry. My great-great-grandfather, John Donnelly. My great-grandfather, Edward Donnelly. And my grandfather, Thomas Donnelly. I knew Thomas. I remember him when I was very small. Thomas was born a few months before Dr. Houston died. I haven't traced the name Thomas in our family before, and I can't help thinking that my grandfather was given his name because of the minister who baptized him, perhaps one of the very last baptized by Houston. Week after week, we're told, even after the affection of his throat had laid him aside from the pulpit, he prepared his weekly sermon and carefully wrote it out. He couldn't speak, but he wrote it out. The last sermon he wrote indicated in a remarkable degree how heaven and earth were linked together in his soul. His text was Philippians 1:23, his last text. Desiring to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. A friend says his suffering at times was very intense, but amid all the painful symptoms of the disease, his faith never wavered. His vision of that Redeemer whom he had preached so long and in whom he believed was never for a moment obscured. And the very last sentence he wrote, writing on a slate, for at this time he was unable to speak, was an expression of his childlike and unwavering faith in God, whatever the issue of his trouble might be. On the final page of his notebook, and we haven't got this note, but we're told about it. On the final page of this notebook, we're told that he had written some verses of a popular current poem. Here's what he wrote. And we shall see how, while we frown and sigh, God's plans go on as best for you and me. How, when we called, he heeded not our cry, because his wisdom to the end could see. And even as prudent parents disallow too much of sweet to craving babyhood, so God, perhaps, is keeping from us now life's sweetest things, because it seemeth good. And you shall shortly know that lengthened breath is not the sweetest gift God sends his friend. And that sometimes the sable pall of death conceals the fairest boon his love can send. And if through patient toil we reach the land where tired feet with sandals loosed may rest, where we shall clearly know and understand, I think that we shall say, God knew the best, written at the end of his last diary. He was operated on in the Royal Hospital, and he died a few years later, on the 27th of March, 1882. His family inscribed on his tombstone, which if you haven't seen it, you can go and see, the back wall outside this meeting house. He inscribed on it words from 2 Chronicles 24:16, which are eloquent in their simplicity. He did good in Israel, both toward God and toward his house. Thank you.